Hello, and welcome to the Let's Talk Transformation podcasts. Today, we will be discussing how organizations can thrive and how they can build the resilience to do so. I'm delighted to welcome Julian Roberts, executive business coach with years of experience in helping both individuals and SME businesses to thrive. So, Julian, welcome to the show.
Well, good to see you, Susie. Thank you for inviting me. I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Likewise, it's great to have you on the show. Julian, I know you spend a lot of your time and research looking at this topic of how organizations can thrive, and more particularly, the collective resilience aspect, both massively important topics for the future of organizations, competitive advantage, but also for creating value through people as we move into a world that is a lot more interconnected and the structures are flatter, in inverted commas. We'll come to that. But a quest we're both equally passionate about. So before we delve deeper into the subject, can we define thriving? What is thriving for you and why is it so important in organizations today?
Yes, that is a great question to ask.
A small one.
A small one. What is thriving? And and it's interesting because it's the opposite to surviving,
yes.
Certainly. You know, surviving is that where you're just getting by. I think sometimes it's good to point out the negative or the flip side of thriving is surviving, where you're struggling, it's difficult, it's hard work, it's sluggish, engagement is really difficult to get within an organization. Everybody feels sort of unproductive and flat. So thriving for me is the flip side of that. It's an environment where everybody is in a good place from the well-being point of view. And it sounds, it's interesting because I've gone on a journey myself, this whole piece about well-being. And it used to be, in my mind, a very woo-woo thing. But actually, well-being is critical for people and for organizations to look after their staff in that way. Mm. But it's a place where people feel they can grow, where they can learn, where they can excel, where they can make mistakes, where they can be vulnerable. That to me is a thriving organization. And the result of a thriving organization or people thriving in that environment is an organization that is pushing the boundaries. It's innovating. It's got high performance linked to it. It's not all about growth, but there's an element of high performance with that. And a place where people really enjoy and feel satisfied and feel engaged and fulfilled in what they're doing. Sounds like utopia, doesn't it?
But it does a little bit, I was thinking.
But that to me is what I would say the extent of what I would call thriving. And it's all about the people. And, you know, and in essence, you know, it's like, you know, putting a plant in the right conditions. And if you put it, give it enough light, water, food, the right soil, all that sort of stuff, then it will grow and thrive if in essence. So it's thinking about the environment you've got within your organization.
It does sound utopian, but it's an ambition, isn't it? And I like the polarities of surviving and thriving, because I think that is exactly what this discussion is about. So, you know, nobody's on top of the game all the time, and high performing teams aren't high performing all the time, or not everybody in that team is high performing all the time. So how do you create the middle ground, let me say, between those two polarities of surviving and thriving? And where does resilience sit for you on that scale?
Okay, another big question. Big question this morning.
Only big ones.
Only big ones. Yeah, you're right to say that we don't just not in constant sort of high performance mode, because that's just unrealistic and not possible in some ways. And to be honest, that's where I think, and I just mentioned this about toxic resilience, where you can border on this fact where everybody's going to be in a good place, everybody's going to be optimistic, everybody's going to be high performing, and you end up this place where it just end up with burnouts, and that's obviously not a very good place to be in. The middle ground is, for me, is it being an environment where people can be open about their challenges, because the fact of life is personal life, work life, they're all interconnected, and life is tough at times. And you know, we all get different challenges in different ways, handle them in different ways, we've all got different experiences. And I think for me, the middle ground is being absolutely real with people. And, you know, I talk about being optimistic. I mean, I'm real an optimist. I love being optimistic about situations. But for me, optimism is defined in the sense of being rooted and anchored in reality, in the now, but also having an eye in the future, which is really obviously positive. And I think for me, that middle ground is about being realistic about where people are at, where you're at. And it's okay to say, I'm finding it really tough today. And it's okay to say, I'm struggling with this. And I think that's the environment. Because if you're part of a team and part of a team that what I would call has been a resilient team, by being open and aware, then the other people can sort of share those burdens. They can share those tasks that perhaps you're finding difficult with. I'll give you an example. I was coaching a rowing team, five ladies who were looking to row around Great Britain, 2,000 miles.
2,000, okay.
All the way with the tides, weather,
wow,
all sorts of shipping lanes, everything else getting in the way. And we came up with, it's part of the thing I call about building resilient processes. They did like I sort of facilitated this session, but they came up with this idea where they'd have a check-in with each other three times a day. They tried to do it as all the sort of breakfast, lunch, dinner time, where they'd try and eat together as such, whilst rowing and everything else they were doing. But what they did at that point, they would each share how they felt in terms of from on a number from 1 to 5. 5 would mean they're absolutely on it, feel good, feel healthy, feel strong, mentally, all that sort of stuff. Mm. 1 being I'm struggling either physically, I feel seasick, whatever. And so they share their number. There are 3, 4, whatever it is, and then just do a very brief why they feel that way. And so each of the 5 would go around the boat, so to speak, share that number, and then each of them know, oh, you're a 1. So, okay, you're not feeling so good today. Perhaps you use a bit more of a lie down. Why are you feeling like that? Is it you feeling sick? I'm not eating enough, whatever it is. And they could then share the load, and it then starts to create this team working and ability to then share that load with each other. But again, that comes out of people being obviously feeling okay and vulnerable to say, I'm struggling today, to be honest. And I guess in the context of rowing in a on a boat, probably helpful, but in an organization, how comfortable would people feel sharing about that is another question.
And I'm hearing, I was going to say, you know, being comfortable to share vulnerability and to share, let's say, solutions or approaches to adversity, which of course is happening all the time in organizations, but in life in general. But I'm also hearing, Julian, that you're operationalizing resilience here, that there is an explicit process that they are putting together as a team to make sure that they're there for each other, but that it's clear in terms of how we show up when somebody's in adversity and what we do collectively, which is really interesting because one of my questions is, you know, you spoke about optimism. I'm a relentless optimist. I like being a relentless optimist. It's not without its drawbacks, of course, but, you know, what is the link for you? Is there a link between character and attitude and resilience?
Yeah, it's an interesting question because, you know, I often have this, I'm all over this question thinking, are people, certain people more resilient than others? And in some ways they are, but I, through my research, through what I've read, through the studies I've sort of done myself, I believe resilience is something you can grow, you can develop and you can expand it, a bit like a muscle. And so therefore you can increase it. I think what we get exposed to prior to experiences gives the opportunity to express and demonstrate resilience. I think for me, the whole resilience, character and sort of attitude type of thing plays a role because, you know, if you have an attitude, you know, say, for example, you wake up in the morning and go, you stub your big toe and it really does hurt.
So I'm just moving my feet as you say that. Yeah.
And you go, oh, I'm going to have a really bad day today. You then set a narrative and you've set an intention in your head that you're going to have a bad day. And it sounds very cliche, but that's what you're doing. And I think we forget how powerful our brains are or what we say and think. And you will then look for confirmation bias of that bad day and you will find bad day, I'm afraid. So I believe the intentions attitude does play a role because, you know, I'm a one for, and this was the optimist in me, is, you know, when a scenario happens, when it's a difficult situation or a challenge or a surprise thing, you know, I always say to people, you know, look for the silver lining and because there always is something in it. And that silver lining could be a learning. It could be a way of galvanizing the team. You know, and I do this exercise with teams when we're looking at challenges. You know, I say to them, we need to flip the script. And again, an old cliche. But what we do, instead of saying this challenge, we look at the challenge and go, you know, what opportunities does this represent for our organization, our team? And just by reframing it differently, you open up your mind to more positive, more opportunities, more ideas, more creativity, and you find these ideas flow. And suddenly this challenge that's got in the way has now given us some opportunities and potential solutions as well. I think there is a link between sort of attitude, you know, and again, it can be the same, you know, if resilience is defined like a muscle, if you're going to go to the gym and build muscle or do running and become, you know, better at running, you have to have an attitude of, you know, positivity, you know, an attitude of doing it and discipline and consistency. Otherwise, things won't happen. They don't just happen by sitting there doing nothing. No. So, yes, I think there is a link. I'm sure the studies, I'm not aware of any studies, but I'm sure there's studies out there that have put those links together.
And it's interesting to see that this going to the gym thing, because you will have very diverse profiles in the team, won't you? So everybody will think differently. Everybody will speak their way into the team differently, and everybody will exercise that muscle or not differently. And I think one of the biggest questions I get asked, and I'm sure you do too, is how can you scale it? So how can you scale this culture or this mindset so that you can create collective resilience? Because if I look at, you know, the idea of organizations as teams of teams, and the sort of flatter, more interconnected organizational design model that's coming in more and more, how do we scale what you're talking about? The rowing team is maybe some of that answer, and what you've just described in terms of the way the teams work and think together. But, you know, how can we scale collective resilience? It's one of those questions I always get asked, and feels huge. So another huge question for you, Julian.
Yeah.
How do you scale collective resilience?
There's a number of ways. I mean, I won't go into detail on all of them, but I've got, for me, is in an organization or in a team, or you're taking a team or to make teams and teams, is that whoever they're part of, they've got to be absolute clarity of the purpose of that organization and mission. And again, that to me is a guiding light, North Star, that will help difficult teams when things happen. I know I was working with a CEO during COVID time, and as we were all in a little bit of what's going on here, not totally sure what's happening. And I said to him, you're a purpose-driven organization. Go back to your purpose, get the team together, galvanize them together, think about the purpose, because that'll help lift their gaze. But also what it also will do is make them be more energized, because it came from a positive energy sort of perspective. And then think about that North Star of your purpose, and think, okay, that's not changed, but what has changed is how we go about it and the timing. And we just need to now navigate around that. And that CEO did that session himself. He facilitated it, and he created different ways of working, innovative solutions, and suddenly they got more energized and they started to overcome. So that's one way of using purpose as sort of in a global context. But I also, in terms of putting processes in place, I talked about one of them, which was the whole sort of sharing each other where we're at, which is vulnerability comes with that, is putting in, I call it, there's the three aspects of the processes. There's what you call reduce, regulate, and repair. Reduce is all about what I'd call like scenario what-if planning, the sort of the iceberg drills, the fire drills, how you want to do it. So you can get a team together and go, okay, let's think about, you know, what could happen to our team, our organization. What sort of difficulties could we, you know, loss of sales, loss of people, various scenarios. And that starts to bring teams together. They start to collaborate. They start to think differently. They start to think of solutions, ideas, and they come up with things, a way to mitigate those difficulties. And it's a really good exercise that I've done a number of times with organizations. And you just see this team suddenly start to come together. And those scenarios may not come to pass, but what happens when something else happens, they're already in a place of how we work this out, because we've done this before on a almost as a pretend way, and now the reality is here, but we've got a process in place. And so that starts to help you scale this ways of working. So you then sort of reduce the opportunities of mitigating those difficulties. And then there's other ways in terms of the repair side of the process. That's all about debriefing, making sure that as you go through difficulties, as you go through even successes, you know, and this is what a lot of organizations don't do. We don't stop, we don't pause, we don't reflect and take time out as a team to, what did we learn from that? What can we do differently? What can we put in place next time? How else should we change our ways of working? And again, this starts to bring teams together. It involves everybody's thinking, gets that different perspectives, and you start to then create this wider resilient approach from a team organizational point of view.
And I think I'm hearing, as you say that, discipline. There's also quite a lot of discipline, isn't there, in building team rituals and in working in a more flexible, flatter way? Because often I hear, oh yeah, flat organizations, it's going to be great. I won't have a boss. I can do what I want. But unless you have clarity of roles and responsibilities and increased discipline for me in terms of how you formalize what's okay, what's not okay, how you work together, then it becomes increasingly difficult, I think, to build any type of collective understanding.
I agree. Yeah, I think discipline is sort of slightly underrated, I think. I think people are all into rah-rah motivational. Motivational things comes and goes, particularly external motivation. Internal intrinsic motivation obviously is a bit more core to who we are. But even so, that I think it can be a bit ebb and flow. Discipline is a decision. It's a commitment. It's a, you're going to decide to do this and put it in as a regular, whether it's check-ins, whether it's debriefs, whether it's what-ifs, whatever it may be. And it sounds very structured, but there's still some fluidity to that. Talk about building personal resilience. I do a, you know, an ice bath every day, and it's a discipline. And you don't get these things that happen in one instance. It takes time to build. And, you know, I get up and literally my first thing I do is I get in the water and while my coffee's brewing and then get out and I have my coffee. And that's a discipline, it's a habit that I've done. And at times, do you know what? I wake up, I think, I don't feel like it. I don't feel like going out in the cold air and then the cold water, but I just do it. I don't really engage my brain too much. I get in and I literally then wake up. But it's a discipline. And I think sometimes we need to be more disciplined and more consistent. And I think consistency is another thing that gets a low sort of rating in life, because whether it's consistency of message, behavior, how you're at, how you do things is so important and so valuable. So yeah, definitely be disciplined, but you know, have the fluidity. You've got to be agile with these things. It's not being, you know, because I'm a one for sort of process, but for me, process is there to serve you, not for you to serve the process. So if you get to a place where the process is not serving you anymore, then you need to change it or do something differently. Mm. And I think, you know, I've been in organizations like yourself, massive organization, where it's very process driven.
Yeah.
And it becomes a bit like, we've got to do this because of this process. Well, actually, is that serving us right now? And I think always check whether something is serving you right now in the right way.
That's a great marker though, isn't it? You know, am I serving the process or is the process serving me? Because if I'm serving the process, there's discipline there, but it's toxic, isn't it? To come back to your point about toxic resilience of, we'll just push through what I call rubber band resilience. I'll just force it and force it and force it, either until the rubber band breaks or I bounce back, but I might not bounce back in the same state. But this whole discussion around accountability and consistency, which brings me to personal agency and therefore authentic leadership. And if I come back to your purpose discussion, in your recent article in Developing Leaders Quarterly, you link, through your research as well, authentic leadership and team resilience. I would love it if you could walk us through that research a little bit and what you found out there.
Yes. Yeah. This is part of my master's in psychology I did sort of a few years ago, having had a very real interest in team resilience and also the role that leadership and particularly is authentic leadership plays. So I did the survey with about 95 people, took part in the survey where they rated their boss in a team on our scale of team of authentic leadership, some questions they were asked, and then they also rated the team resilience of their team again from questions they asked. I asked them, and based on that, there's a correlation that authentic leadership promotes and increases the resilience of a team. And we just go back one thing in terms of what is authentic leadership, because it might mean
I was just about to ask you that.
Many
question for you, Julian.
Many things to many people, and a lot of people talk about it and think, but I use the premise that there's four components to authentic leadership. And the first one is all about self-awareness, being incredibly self-aware of who you are, what you are, the impact you have on others, the influence you have on others. And that's really, obviously, important, generally as a leader anyway, but in terms of authentic leadership. Balanced processing is another aspect where you consider other people's opinions, thoughts, inputs before you make a decision. It doesn't mean you just take everybody's thoughts, but you take that balanced processing, understanding, and gather, and then you make a decision. And then this whole piece of internal moral perspective, you have some values, you have beliefs that you hold fast to, but also with that, that you show and demonstrate that through your actions as well. And then the final one is that you're open and transparent in terms of how you make decisions, who you are, what you are. So they're the sort of four components of authentic leadership. And it's more than just being who you are. It's quite a collective things there. And how that interacted with the whole team resilience piece, there was two aspects of the authentic leadership sort of construct, really. Mm. That was one that really correlated with promoting team resilience. The first one was self-awareness. And the reason this sort of promotes team resilience is because, for me, resilience is all about, as much as adapting to the challenges and this element of pushing through, but it's also learning through that process. And learning is a really key part in a team, in an organization, to build resilience. And the self-awareness within a leader means they're more open to their weaknesses as well as their strengths. They're more likely to be in a learning mindset and promote a learning mindset as well. And so what happens is those self-aware leaders are more akin to creating a culture of learning, which therefore creates this more resilient organization. And then the other one was the internal moral perspective was a driver within driving to team resilience. And this was all about, because when you've got sort of morals, beliefs, values, it means you're more purposeful, means you're more about having a meaningful contribution, and you expect that in others. And the fact that you value purpose above anything else then starts to create this North Star. I talked about having a purpose in an organization helps with resilience. And so authentic leaders tend to lead from a more purposeful point of view and therefore create an organization or a team that more aware of purpose as a guiding light, which then helps them navigate those difficult situations. So that's a very quick synopsis of the authentic leadership and team resilience. And I think it just, for me, shows that leadership does play a role within that.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, and I think one other fundamental thing for me about leadership is that, you know, to create, you know, resilient team, you need to create an environment of psychological safety, which is all about a place where people can share, take risks, can innovate, challenge, all those sort of things. And that comes the responsibility of a leader to create that environment.
And I think that I'm interested in the trends that you were seeing on the research you did around self-awareness and how pivotal that was, because my view on that is it's the starting point for everything. You know, in every single challenge in life, getting over yourself for me is the first, or understanding how you get triggered and therefore how you react is the pivotal piece. What were you seeing in that research compared to the other three pillars? I'm calling them pillars, components, or
it was probably more out of all the other out of the four components, it was probably the highest in terms of significance. Was self-awareness. Self-awareness had a greater impact on creating a resilient team, definitely.
Because if we come back to the place of, because they're basically walking their talk, aren't they? Authentic leaders, that people, I mean, that's what we do. We watch leaders to see if they do what they say. And that's what's inspiring when they do and they take us on their journey, which is purpose fueled, of course. But if I look at, we spoke about optimism and also hope, things that are sort of fluffy concepts. If you look at what organizations want to measure and how we want to put KPIs on things, what is the place of those two things for you in building resilience, I suppose, but therefore in the leadership that builds resilience? Because, you know, I don't see a lot of hope and optimism often when I first step into organizational constructs, let's put it that way. whether it's teams or departments or functions. And the higher you go, the less you see.
Yeah, hope and optimism you could call them fluffy, but do you know what? They're fluffy good stuff to have.
Yeah, absolutely.
In people. And authentic leadership actually has a lot of hope and optimism within them, within the sort of constructs. And there's been studies that have done that leaders who have high hope have more profitable organizations, they have more fulfilled staff, they have a lower turnover of staff as well. So there's a real link between hope and thriving, in essence, within your organization. And to me, thriving then becomes resilience as well. Yeah, so
absolutely.
Yeah, I think it's important because it all stems back from your intentions. You know, I said right at the start, you know, if your intention is optimistic, your intention is hopeful. Because hopeful is you see not only positivity in the future of an organization, but you also see that in people. Mm. And this is the important aspect, is that you have a high hope for somebody. We have that expression, don't we? I've got high hopes for you, Susie, in this role. Mm. Actually, it means you've got an expectation. It means you see some potential. That means you want to nurture that. You want to support that. And I think that's from a conscious but also subconscious makes that person feel valued and feel they want to not just meet your high hopes, but meet the expectations that actually somebody feels, I feel valued and feel they want me to do really well and supportive. Mm. And so actually being hopeful, optimistic in an intention and an approach creates that within people. And then therefore people start to feel more engaged, more productive, and then more sense of more like to be more in a thriving organization.
Mm. And if you, as you will, always get people who don't believe that, who are naysayers, who are sitting there going, yeah, right, no, I don't believe that, we're never going to do that. How do you bring them in, Julian, in terms of getting them into a place of glass half full, even if they're a glass half empty, if I use that analogy?
I think it's asking their experiences of people they've met and people that have inspired them. You know, I'm a little strong believer that role modeling is probably the most powerful way to influence people, teams, and cultures, walking the talk and being transparent and open with all that. And I'd ask them, you know, who's inspired you, you know, and why did they inspire you? What was it about them? And probably be something along hope, optimism, and positivity will come out of it. And I appreciate, you know, I don't, because in some ways, I feel sometimes positivity can come a bit toxic as well. Yes. Positive talk. Yeah. I don't like the extreme of, yay, everything's great, you know, the sick is sinking and we're all going to be fine and playing our music. I'm not into that. No. I mean, let's be real about things as well and call things out and say, look, do you know what? This is a really bad situation at the moment, but we need to act on this. So there's an element of realism, but also it's that link to that optimistic future as well. I've got an eye in the future. So yes, I would ask them who's inspired them and then take it from there. And I would guarantee they'll probably say along the lines that they were optimistic, hopeful, whatever it is, more positive.
I come back to your earlier point though, isn't it? You're grounding your optimism in reality, which means that once you're in their reality, then there's that space to say, if we flip it, what opportunities do we have as well as what challenges? Yep. So I really like that idea. Thank you. So if I look at how leaders intentionally can create this culture, I know we've touched on psychological safety, but particularly senior leaders, creating the conditions for people to thrive. And I think that does equal collective resilience, you know, communities and teams thriving. How can they do that? We've touched on some ways, but particularly in a hybrid environment, Julian, where I feel that hybrid working can become so transactional so quickly if we let it. So how do they bridge that gap?
Yeah, I think it is a real challenge. And I know we've been sort of doing it now 4 years, but I think there's still some massive learnings. I think we go back to the principles of you've got to keep people connected and communicate in that context and think of ways how, you know, we think purpose is a fundamental, you know, driver. I believe it's a fundamental driver in building resilience, or one aspect of building resilience. Is how do you communicate that? How do you live that? How do you share that in a context of hybrid? And whether that's, you know, those sort of town hall meetings regularly on a Zoom, which are not the best thing, but there's some ways encouraging people to come in. And when people are in together, come in, you know, teams on the same day, that type of, for example. I really think that's a really important thing, is to make sure, you know, all coming on a Wednesday, Thursday, all coming on Wednesday and Thursday. And so you're actively together, because it comes when you start interacting. And we know that remote working, there's some real benefits for it.
Yeah.
But also, it, as you say, you just go on a call for a particular task and then you go off again and you're only on for half an hour, whatever it is. And it does become very transactional, and you miss those nuances of getting up, going have a grabbing a coffee, or wandering around, or just little side chats you have with people around the table, that sort of stuff. So I would always encourage some ways of getting people together, whether you do that on a weekly basis, whether you do that formally as a quarterly thing, off-site, you know, instead of just being work orientated, start thinking about social stuff you can do that can facilitate that. And I appreciate people might be far flung around the world or around the country, but look at ways of bringing that connection. You know, I'm an advocate for hybrid because there's some real benefits. You know, my daughter's just got a first job in London and she works hybrid, and the flexibility is brilliant. But I've said to her, try and get in the office as much as possible, because you can engage more, learn more, and ask for your profile, but you just get a lot more out of it just by being around people, observing people. And again, goes back to that role modeling piece. Make sure you can, you know, role model. And so can be done remotely, but you just got to be a bit more intentional about it, and perhaps a bit more, far more disciplined in how you do that, and think about, how am I engaging my team? How am I connecting with my team this week? You know, whether it's a weekly check-in, whether it's a, you have your Zoom open every morning at, for an hour or something, where people can just come in and have a chit chat or something like that. There's ways of doing it, but have the premise of thinking, how can I be connected, and look at opportunities to create that.
Thank you. I like that idea of what I used to call the open door policy of, okay, my door's open for coffee, or, you know, whatever, from 9 till 10 on a Friday. I haven't thought of doing that via Zoom. So I think that's a really good idea, if you could just drop in and say hi or not.
Yes. you don't have to let them in.
Yeah. We always put a waiting room on it.
Exactly, yes.
So, Julian, time is running, but I do have a couple of questions. I have a question for you around the most transformative thing that you've ever done in this space of working with and for resilience.
I think it would be going back to my working with the five ladies who rode around. Well, they didn't quite make it actually around, but from a resilient point of view, because they came to me, they were a team of five that didn't really know each other.
Okay. Oh, wow.
Some were experienced rowers, some weren't. And fair to say, they were probably a bit of a ramshackle at the start. And so for me, I spent 12 months working with them all online. Actually, I didn't meet them until almost a year later.
Ah, that's interesting.
In person. This was all done online. And surprisingly, it worked. But we went from this team that didn't really work, didn't have any processes, the dynamics were all over the shop, to a team that were communicating well together, working well together, making decisions together, but also building this mental toughness, mental and resilient processes along the way. And it was just great to see this transformation of gathering a load of people who were fairly independently resilient and go for it, came together and all was a bit chaotic, to a team that were high performing, and, you know, made them do such a great task, get to the start line in such a good place. And it was quite a, you know, quite a proud moment when they sort of set to row from Tower Bridge in London and see them go off. Unfortunately, they got caught up in a storm off the coast of Wales. They were about 500 miles into the actual race. And this storm had, like, you know, 30-foot waves. They damaged some part of their boats. And then they had to call the lifeboat out, who then came and rescued. They were basically drifting to a shipping lane and they had no control. So they had to be called, rescued. And so they were rescued. And in fact, the lifeboat said to them that it was the worst storm since 1972 that they'd experienced. But they got back to shore, and this, amidst the madness, I thought, and they said, oh, we want to get back on again, get out there again. And I was thinking, seriously? And so they wanted to get back up. They wanted that, but they couldn't, because there was some damage to the boat that needed to be fixed, and there wasn't enough time. But they've gone on to be, you know, as much as they were disappointed they didn't complete it and didn't finish it, because they're going for world record, they've gone on to do different things. And, you know, it just shows, you know, life's not always about outcomes and goals.
No.
And because they had an overarching purpose, they were collecting data for the University of Portsmouth for some sort of climate change data from various things around. So they were doing something bigger than themselves, which goes back to the purpose piece. My purpose is really helpful, because at the end of it, I didn't hit my goal, but we got closer to the purpose and we gave data for 500 miles of our trip. And so, yeah, that was it. That was probably the most transformative in the last few years. And it was quite novel doing something like working with a sport team, I guess.
Yeah, sounds exciting. And that, you know, real adversity, that storm sounds quite scary.
Terrible, yes. I mean, when they relayed it, I mean, it's like, my goodness. I mean, they were literally being bounced around. And there was two other boats in the race, one capsized, and then they had to be rescued. And then another one, they got rescued with a helicopter as well, came over them and rescued. Yeah, I know, it's just crazy.
The full thing. And Julian, what was your biggest learning from that? What was your biggest learning around sort of resilience, team resilience?
When I reflect on that whole process working with them, it was not getting caught up with goals and outcomes, because you know, I used to talk about purpose a lot with them, and then you know, and when the reality comes, difficulties, and also, you know, they didn't hit the outcome and they were disappointed about it, and we used that in the debrief. That was my learning. Actually, this purpose piece does really matter. It's not a fluffy, oh, that's a nice thing to know, your purpose, the team purpose, lots of actually, it does really work, and it helps you get through difficulties and challenges and overcome things. And I think that's my biggest learning. The actual stuff we did does really work, you know, and despite the difficulties that they faced in a reality of a boat. Yeah.
Oh, that was quite difficult conditions to test it in. So, yeah.
Yes.
Julian, would you have any call to action for our leaders listening around creating resilience?
Well, I mean, apart from, you know, I've got a book coming out the end of the year, hopefully. Talk a bit more about this. So that'd be night end, sort of September, October time.
Tell me more about your book. What is it about?
Yeah, it's basically how to create resilient teams. That's the core of it. It's all about how to build that using purpose, to psychological safety, resilient processes, and various other things as well. I think the call to action really is, you know, think about your organization, your team, and get a sense of how resilient do you think they are. I mean, I'm happy to have a conversation with you, but just, yeah, how did you navigate your last challenge? What happened to your emotions in your team? What happened to the process in the team? What happened? So almost look back at an example and think, did you get through it okay? Or was there ways of you could learn from that? And that's a good place to start.
So taking a step back to observe, notice what they notice, and learn from that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, excellent. I'm going to leave our listeners with that. Julian, thank you for coming on and sharing your research, your thoughts, your insight on this topic. Where can people find out more about you, your upcoming book, and what you do?
Yeah, well, thank you, Susie, for inviting me on here. It's been a great conversation. You can find me on LinkedIn, obviously under Julian Roberts. You can look at my face and you'll see me there. I do also a podcast as well, so you can sort of find that there. But also, you can go to my website, which is julianrobertsconsulting.com.
Okay, excellent. I'll put the links to all those in the show notes so that our listeners can find them quickly. Thank you, Julian. It's been a great conversation.
Yeah, thank you, Susie. Much appreciated.